Harry Cooper and yours truly, along with David Deeds. David is our just peerless, magnificently talented and gifted and humble artist at Rents.com, and his art is seen all around the world. He has truly attained a position in political art that has never been, well, he's recreated political art is what he's done. And now he is producing the most wonderful, evocative, emotive covers in World War II books I have ever seen. We're looking at the books by Harry Cooper. Look at Harry Cooper's name in Guests at Rents. Look at Books by Harry Cooper. Click on that line under his name. It's the second line. And you'll pull the page up, and we're looking at those books right now. David, when you look at the picture, originally I think I sent you three, but when you look at the picture of Adolf Hitler on the back cover, and had all three been in there, there wasn't room for them, but I think they really show the unquestionable doubt that that's the same face. That's the man.
That is the man. You were talking about his nostril. Yeah, that's a very telling detail. That it looks exactly like when people age, the nose, the ears, and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. He. How old was he when he died, Harry?
He died in 1962 or 63. So do the math. He was born 1889.
That would make him 74, 75.
Thereabouts, yeah.
And he doesn't have the mustache there, you can see.
No.
Right, no. When Don Angel met with him in 1952, Don Angel said he had gone bald and he had no more mustache.
Well, that's...
Incidentally, one of our guys, Pizarro, has learned the name of the double that took his place in the bunker, and that was in the last issue of the magazine. You got that.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Now, was he the one that they put a bullet in his head and put him outside to be found by the Soviets, or was that somebody else?
We're not sure just yet.
Okay. All right. Well,
but also, if you think about from his viewpoint, he everybody was told that he was dead. And so he was in Argentina watching the whole world talk about his death and create all these dastardly things that he did, like the so-called Holocaust. And he got to live until, 1963. And he saw so many things. It's so interesting when you think about that they were alive and how heartbroken they must have been to see Germany so destroyed by the people.
And continue to be destroyed from 1945 to 1953, where 5 to 8 million more Germans were butchered by world Zionism to kill off any residual patriotic German identity. That's what their game was. And Germany has been on its knees ever since.
The new generation, though, I'm in contact with a lot of people over there. The new generation, which is about the third generation after the war, they're not believing it. They're not. They're getting tired of the sackcloth and ashes.
That's right.
And we're trying to find a translator now who will put our book into German, because some of our German members have been just pushing the hell out of us.
Can't believe it hasn't happened already. Any of you people in Germany listening, it doesn't cost a whole hell of a lot to have a book translated. Let's put the money together and get this done. Okay? Maybe the German government will outlaw it. It's for sale in Germany, but you can buy it overseas and have it shipped in. So get it. Let's get
right.
It done.
It's going to be released within the next week or two in the French language.
Good.
Michael Ivanheim's daughter is translating it into Spanish, so that ought to be big down in South America and in Spain.
Very
good.
But
now we need to get it into German, and because there's a lot of people in Germany would love to learn their history.
Indeed, the truth. All right, well, there it is, Hitler in Argentina, David Dee's artwork, Harry Cooper and his incredible associates have put the truth there. Let's scroll down and look at When Eagles Soared, Volume 1. Did you select the font is perfect, David. It's almost evocative of World War I. In its breadth, but look at that plane and look at the man behind it. The man behind it was so incensed that Adolf Hitler didn't, still in World War One in some ways, in Hitler's own mind, would not allow the Messerschmitt 262, which he had access to by 1942, to be turned into an air superiority fighter. He didn't get it. He wanted it to be a Schnell bomber to fly over and drop bombs or a bomb on London and fly back. No one can touch it. Yeah, and he wasted 2 years. Had he not done that, the war would have been much different. I don't know how it would have ended. You overrun people with so many others, you overrun them. But still, they would have swept the skies clean of some of these bomber formations. Lots of them. Hey, David, what about this book and Adolf Galland?
Well, this cover is depicting an aerial battle. I chose the this. It's a Messerschmitt there, right? I'm not sure exactly which model.
That's an ME-109, yeah.
Well, technically,
that's Galland,
it's a,
right?
A B, yeah, that's Galland. And it's Galland. Technically, it's a BF-109, but everyone says ME.
Fire and Flugzeug.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
I just chose the most dynamic angle that I could. It's dive bombing with full machine guns going, and in the background you can see a British plane exploding. I don't know what model that is. I don't know all the numbers of the technical part of all this. But
that's a Spitfire.
And maybe some of the first chemtrails there because, it's actually black smoke, but it's a lot of lines in the sky. A lot of activity. You know, I was looking at some of the dogfights taken from the machine gunner. The machine gunners had a spot sometimes at the front of the plane and in the back, and they would have, they would take movies of these battles, and I was looking at some of these. Holy smokes, you know, we're talking about danger on a level that no one even can comprehend. And these planes, you think, you know, the B-17 was called a flying fortress. Well, I was studying the photograph. The inside of it is not much wider than a big Jeep. You know, it's a very small plane considering, you know, what sort of situation they put themselves in, being surrounded by all these Stukas and the Messerschmitts, you know, shooting them down. You know, I really was able to feel the danger and it scared me really bad. I have to say is that I got really scared researching some of this stuff and the feelings I got from it.
I want to say one other thing. The plane on the cover of the book, I want all of you to take a look right under the cockpit window on the side of the fuselage. What do you see?
Yeah, his emblem.
You see Adolf Galland's favorite little cartoon character by the name of Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse smoking a cigar with a six-shooter in his hand.
And I sent two videotapes to Mrs. Galland of 1930s Walt Disney Mickey Mouse cartoons for Adolf, and he got them, and she wrote me a very lovely letter back.
Yeah, he's gone now. He died under the knife on the operating table. He was having open-heart surgery some years ago. He was a member of Shark Hunters. And
did you ever meet him?
No, never met him. We wrote back and forth, but most of the U-boat guys I met, but Galland I didn't meet. I did meet Gunter Rall, as I said, and spent a day with him. Hans Eckhard Bob. He flew the jet fighters, Hans Eckhard Bob did, and he signed one of our prints, which you can find on our store. And we also have, you mentioned gun camera footage. We've got DVDs, and many of them have actual gun camera stuff. Some of them from the Japanese Air Force shooting down British planes. So the gun cameras, there'll never be air war again like this, where the men actually saw their opponent through a spinning propeller and had to aim the plane to shoot the other guy down. Now they just, I was in the Air Force, so I was a weapons specialist, and they just fly off and they stay on a radar beam, and then their little scope says fire, you push a button, and you turn around and go home.
Well, exactly, Harry, and they're the forward shooting cannons or machine guns on the BF-109s or any of the planes. When you were in a dogfight in combat, you had to lead your opponent with your gunfire. They call it deflection. And Eric Hartmann was a genius at deflection. He would know how to shoot, how far ahead of the plane. So by the time the bullets arrived, they'd arrive on target.
Right. Well, he must have learned something, right, with 352 confirmed shootdowns.
Yeah, his story is incredible.
And also, you have to consider how he would dodge, you know, anybody shooting at him to be able to be in that much aero combat to not get shot down. Technique that you could ever avoid so much fire.
He had a great wingman, too, by the way.
Right, he had a great wingman, and he stayed out of dogfights. He'd dive, he'd pick out his target, dive on him, gun the guy down, and keep right on.
His job was to reduce the enemy's air potential.
Yeah, by attrition.
Yeah.
And just like the U-boats, what they did was they were so dangerous, the U-boats were so dangerous, that they started putting weapons on the freighters that were the cargo ships started to have weapons on them, and so now the U-boats, the submarines, you know, had orders to shoot to fire torpedoes on them too. So you had not necessarily a warship that suddenly was being sunk with a lot of people on it, you know.
Well, yeah, they started arming the freighters, which made them fair targets. Prior to that, they abided by the cruiser rules or the prize rules, where they'd stop a ship and check the cargo manifest, and if it was carrying war material, they'd let the crew get off into the lifeboats and then sink the ship. But after a while, they didn't dare come to the surface because, as David said, they armed them, but not with depth charges or anything like that, but with guns, cannons. And so if a submarine would surface, his element of surprise was gone, and they had 3-inch and 5-inch deck guns, and they could easily blow a submarine out of the water. So that's why they started firing from underneath. And the U-boats, they'd get within 300, 400 yards of a ship to make sure they hit it, whereas the American boats would fire from 1,500 yards out or 1,000 yards out. And I hope our Italian friends don't take this as an insult, but the Italian submarines that see a smudge of smoke on the horizon, fire 6 torpedoes, go home and claim they sank 3 battleships and get the gold medal for it. The Germans got so close that they'd be rocked by the explosion of their own torpedoes.
Well, that was...
Kretschmer would get inside of a convoy.
Germans were winning the war...
Kretschmer
were really winning the war at that point because they were controlling all the boats, right?
Well, pretty much, yeah. And Kretschmer, like I say, he was a good friend of mine right up until the time he died in a horrible accident. He'd get inside the convoy, and nobody could get him. And his motto was one ship, one torpedo. Hmm. And he was the top submarine commander of World War II.
It all turned when the British cracked the Germans' Enigma secret transmission code.
And right, Black May of 1944.
I will never understand why the Germans didn't routinely change the code. I don't understand.
43, I'm sorry.
43.
Well, not only that, Jeff. Black May of 43 was when the code was cracked. It's also when Huffduff came on high-frequency direction finder.
Yeah.
Prior to that, you would have to rotate a loop to get the direction a radio signal was coming from, and the U-boat radio operator could send out what they call a Kurt signal. It took 2 or 3 seconds, and it had a bunch of coded letters which told their position, how much fuel they had, what torpedoes they had, etc. And in 2 or 3 seconds, it was impossible to triangulate using the old RDF. But when Huffduff came on the scene, as soon as that guy hit the key, he was triangulated, and within 15 minutes, bombers were overhead. And in the case of the Type 14, the seagoing gas stations, you want to call them, the U-boat tankers that would fill the other boats in combat, they had no concept of security. We talked to some guys who met one of the U-tankers near the Azores.
Milch cow.
Milk cow, that's correct. 2 Type 9 C U-boats came alongside, one on either side, a distance of 100, 200 feet off, and they were taking on fuel. And he said as soon as they got to the surface, they doubled the men on the anti-aircraft guns, doubled the lookouts on the Type 9s. But the Type 14, nobody was at the guns. The guys were just lounging at the rail smoking. And once they the two front boats, as they call them, the combat boats, once they got their fuel load, they took off in opposite directions. And with less than a half hour after they left the milk cow, they could hear the milk cow on the radio sending messages back to the base explaining, long radio messages. So the two Type 9s pulled the plug and went down, and within 15 minutes they heard explosions from back where the Type 14 had been, and it was no more. They were a high priority target by the U.S. because they could keep 5, 6, 7 front boats on station longer by giving them extra fuel.
Got it. Wow. All right. Let's look at the second cover on the page. This is dedicated to the Army Air Corps. It shows a B-17, the Memphis Belle.
Right. Bob Morgan was a member of Shark Hunters, too.
Wow. And
he died.
Uh-huh.
He died a rather weird way. He, he married a much younger woman, Linda, and she was his manager, et cetera. And they were in, I think it was Charleston or Charlotte, I'm not sure which one. And they were walking, and he tripped and fell off the curb and banged his head, and that was it.
Ah, strange.
Hell of a way.
Yeah. David?
But his plane was the first one to complete the obligatory 25 missions to be rotated home.
Yeah, now what you've done is just, I mean, I when I see that picture under the title, When Eagle Soared, Volume 2, I look at the man kissing the gal, and you hear the song, I'll Be Seeing You. I mean, that's, you've captured the nostalgic epoch of American history perfectly with that cover.
Yeah.
There's a lot of romance with this cover. It's the colors I chose and putting the couple, it was very romantic, and it's, they painted on the front of the aircraft there, the Memphis Belle, and they put a pinup girl. I guess, you know, I don't know the exact story there, but I know that, she probably inspired this whole art, right?
Well, all the planes, most of the planes had pinups. Some of them were so, they went over the top with revealing certain parts of the women, and the commanding officers forced them to change them or cover them up.
Put some bathing suits on them,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They called that nose art, because it was art on the nose of the plane.
There's a book
out.
But
with the Memphis Belle, Morgan, when he was a young cadet, he had a girlfriend from Memphis. And she was a Southern Belle, and I guess she was the fiancé, but the marriage never happened. They broke up or something, and he married somebody else. And then later on, either his wife either died or they got divorced, I don't remember which. But Linda, I can't remember her last name before she married him, she wanted to be an airplane salesman, so she got her pilot's license when she was in her late 20s. And then she met Morgan, and they got married. And she managed his appearances, et cetera. And then, like I say, he was walking and tripped off the sidewalk and hit his head.
Yeah, wild. By the way, one quick thing, David. When you look, folks, at the B-17, you younger people, the Americans are producing so many. They produced over 10,000 of those.
Yeah.
And they would send them over Germany in formations of up to 1,000 airplanes at a time.
Yeah.
And I've talked to
three
Germans.
Three different levels.
That's right. I've talked to Germans who were there as young kids, and they'd go outside the cities, of course, and sit on the hills, and they'd watch these raids. And they said when the planes came, you could hear them before you could see them, the rumbling. The ground shook. And then the bombs were dropped. It was just a horrific thing. And they did that
to
Germany.
They referred to that as the aluminum overcast.
There you go. They did that to Germany from 1941 on. And somehow the Germans continued to fight. They moved all their aircraft production facilities underground. They ran out of fuel. They ran out of pilots. And yet they were still at it at the end. It's just an extraordinary effort to survive.
They were
survive.
Tough combat soldiers, that's for sure, in whatever branch. They were tough combatants. They just didn't know how to quit.
Yeah. They couldn't kill the Soviet hordes fast enough. Their machine guns would actually melt down The barrels would become misshapen, apparently. They just couldn't.
What a lot of people don't realize is that that the Third Reich never surrendered. Jodl and Keitel surrendered the military, mm-hmm. but the government of the Third Reich never surrendered because they had disappeared. The same as the Civil War or the War of Northern Aggression, as you want to call it. The South never surrendered. The government never surrendered. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia against orders, but the government of the Confederate States never surrendered. The government of the Third Reich never surrendered. Hell of a note, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Okay, let's, well, we have just a minute left, but let's move on to the first of the U-boat covers. Again, Volume 1, Stories from the Men of the U-boat Waffe, and it is extraordinary. Now, that is a color photograph, folks, from the war. That's amazing.
That's a Type 7.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I'm not sure if it was colorized. You know, I worked with a lot of photographs. When you go to research this, there's tons of photographs. Not very many of them are good quality that you want to put on the cover of a book, but
yeah.
I was able to recreate some of the scenes and sort of put it from a viewpoint. For instance, the second cover is from the viewpoint of the water and having a sinking ship, and then the periscope, the skipper's on the periscope underneath the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting way to illustrate underwater and above water at the same time.
Well,
the boat you've got depicted, it's an interesting story. That's U-30, and the skipper there, that's Fritz Julius Lemp, who was the skipper of U-30. And the radio operator on that boat was a member of Shark Hunters. He just passed away last year. He was a good friend of mine, Jörg Hugel. And this submarine has the distinction of being many firsts. It was the first boat into combat. It was the first boat to fire a torpedo. They blew up a rock they thought was a cruiser. It was the first boat to sink a ship. They sank the liner Athenia, which they weren't supposed to sink. And so Hugel himself had to tear the pages out of his logbook that covered that because it was a huge international incident. They were the first boat into a captured French port. They came into Lorient when the city was still in flames. And that was a Type 7A. There were only 10 built, and by 1941, five of them were already sunk.
Wow.
So much for the happy times.
Yeah,
Otto French
indeed.
Created that term.
Indeed. All right, we'll be right back with more in just a couple minutes. Okay, Harry Cooper in Florida, and David Dees on the West Coast, and we're talking about World War II, happened long ago. For those of you saying, well, why aren't you talking about American military people and Navy people and British and French? Well, they get the lion's share of the publicity. We're talking about the underdogs here who didn't get that kind of, shall we say, glorified coverage, which quite frankly is what it was. It was propaganda. It was wartime. And even since then, it hasn't changed much. Volume 3, David?
Volume 3, I had the idea of showing, while I was researching that these aircraft carriers were in the Atlantic, and did a submarine ever sink one of those? And yes, they did. And if you did, you got the Knight's Cross medal for sinking one, that or a battleship, I believe. And there, the cover you see, there is no there's no image like this. I built this out of explosions and finding out what a torpedo looks like skimming under the water. You know, I remember as a kid, I saw a lot of war movies, and you know, I used to see that image of the torpedo that was just under the surface, and
Serious
you know, it was
stuff.
Stuck in my head.
Yeah.
So I wanted to recreate that, and so I've got a. It's a pretty simple image, but it's very powerful. I think it shows an aircraft carrier being hit by a torpedo. With a very dark sky behind.
We had several Jeep carriers. That's what they call them, Jeep carriers, because they were built on the 11,000-ton cruiser frames. And there was one that did get sunk just, I think it was off Gibraltar. I'm not sure. But
how many aircraft could they carry? What, 10, 15?
Two dozen.
Uh-huh.
Two dozen. Yeah, because they had the hangar deck down below. They had the elevators to bring them down below. And... then they also had that was the CVL, I think, the light carrier, 11,000 tons. Then they had the CVEs, like the USS Guadalcanal, which was built on a 5,000-ton cargo ship hull. But the USS, the Bogue, USS Bogue did get sunk by a German submarine, which... in turn got pounced on by the destroyers, and it got sunk. That was usually, if you attacked an American surface fleet with the Jeep carrier, you were going to get whacked, because those were the hunter-killer groups. They were not escorting convoys that had to watch out for their ships. These guys would go out with a light carrier, and four or five destroyers or destroyer escorts, and all they did was hunt submarines. And I had to chuckle. They did a documentary on the capture of U-505, and the radio officer on board the Guadalcanal, they interviewed him, and he had a high, squeaky voice, and he said, "Imagine that in this whole huge ocean, we just happened to run onto this German submarine." "No, you dummy. They were sent there because we had cracked the code." Of course, they didn't know that at the time, and Captain Gallery, he became Rear Admiral later, he damn near got court-martialed over it because two things. First off, he wasn't supposed to capture any submarine. He was supposed to sink it, and they captured the boat 2 days before D-Day, and they were just scared to death that the Germans would find out they captured the boat and had the codes, which would have caused them to change their codes for the whole D-Day invasion. We'd have been coming in blind, but we had their codes. That's how they knew to send the Guadalcanal Task Force there. And the second reason, the commander of a ship is not supposed to leave his ship. The commander of a task group is not supposed to leave his flagship. He went aboard 505 after they captured it. He wanted to see his new toy. He got out of that by saying he was demolition trained, and he wanted to disarm the so-called scuttling charges.
Mm-hmm.
There were no scuttling charges on submarines. Who would go to war in a ship of any kind, knowing that there was charges on board that, you know, when the enemy got you cornered, you just push this button and blow yourself out of the water? It don't work that way. There were no scuttling charges, but he ducked a court-martial that way. And that's the submarine that wound up in Chicago.
And still there today.
Oh, yeah. I've got more hours on board that submarine than some of the crew, because I was born and raised in Chicago. I watched that thing get pulled up on the shore of Lake Michigan.
No kidding. Still with its markings on it?
No, they had repainted, and it said U-505 on the side. Prior to that, it had the Shell Oil emblem on the side, and that's a long story. But, you know, that was my 15th birthday, Labor Day weekend of 1954. We were going down Lakeshore Drive to go around the bottom of Lake Michigan to Granddad's farm to spend the long weekend. And I looked at it, I thought to myself, who the hell would want this thing? Well, now I know.
Do they want to keep it in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. They've just gone through a huge renovation. They moved it. It had been set next to the Museum of Science and Industry, and then they built an addition across the front of it, an addition to the museum. Then they built another one along the starboard side, so suddenly now the submarine was inside of a giant U.
Huh.
So you c- could hardly see it. So they built a new structure for it, and they moved it, and from what I understand, it's really well preserved. Of course, the guides there don't have a clue. These are a bunch of people who don't know what the hell they're talking about. Some of my people went through it and told me that the guide was saying that when it was captured, some of the crew had American money and U.S. cigarettes on them.
Oh, yeah.
And they said they had been ashore on the east coast of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to explain to them that boat was never in American waters, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, they didn't want to. They had fact checkers, they said.
Mm-hmm.
I told them we'd check anything they needed for them for free so they wouldn't look stupid. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, they had fact checkers.
Yeah, they don't.
The guy who used to be the head of the museum there, Jack Kahn, was a super guy. He and I had a great rapport. Anything they needed to know about the submarine, he'd call. We'd go there. Everything was fine. Then he retired, and they got a guy who had been in charge of the buses in Chicago, and he's on some kind of ivory tower. You can't even talk to him. I used to be able to just pick up the phone and call Jack Kahn. You can't even talk to this guy. He's got stooges and underlings, and I guess, you know, he's from the same place Barack Obama is, so I guess he's the emperor of the museum.
All right.
But we'll let that one pass.
Yeah, we will for the moment. Lots to talk about. Here's the music. That means we pause for our last break. We'll come back and take a look at two, three more
sharkhunters.com.
covers.
Sharkhunters.com.
And indeed, sharkhunters.com. What a website. All right,
Thank you.
Okay, and we're back. All right, we're talking with David Dees, the artist of the books in question right now. We're looking at those. You can just click under Harry Cooper's name on books, and you'll see them. We're looking at Volume 4, which is really another masterpiece. This is a night scene. Just amazing. Why were these boats on the surface running all lit up like Disneyland at night? You'd think that they'd go dark.
Well, the neutral ships, I mean, ships from neutral countries, were required to be well lit.
Uh-huh.
And that way, they had their national flag painted on the side of the ship. So, you know, if it was Portuguese or various other neutral countries, they wouldn't get shot. So they'd be all lit up at night. And a lot of times the submarines would spend hours chasing down a ship, getting into a proper firing position and only to find out it was a neutral ship. Okay, fine. We wasted a lot of time. Let's go find somebody else. Give me a couple of seconds. I want to tell you a couple funny stories about the guys on these covers, if I may.
Sure.
On Volume 2, that's Eric Topp, the third most successful submarine commander of the war. I've been in his home many times over there, and he came over in the year 2000 for a big convention we had. There were several U-boaters, several Soviet skippers, etc. And so we got him a nice room in the hotel, and I was talking to him on the phone, and he said he was a widower by then. He says, Harry, I have a nurse who travels with me. I said, okay, we'll get her the room next to yours with a door between. No, she must be in my room to take care of me. I said, okay, fine, Eric. You don't argue with these old guys. So I went to pick him up at the airport Okay, we got him the penthouse suite for him and his nurse. He was 82, and here he comes with his nurse. She's a gorgeous 22-year-old. So I told my wife about it, and I said, when I get to be 82, I want a nurse like that. My wife says, you talk like that, you ain't going to make it to 82. Then if you look at the cover of U-Boat 5, the upper left-hand corner, that's Reinhard Hardagen. I've been to his home in Germany, I don't know how many times. He's been here twice to visit. He turned 101 last March. He's closing in on 102 this current March.
Wow.
And I got an email from his oldest son, and he said the three kids, two sons and a daughter, they're panic-stricken because their father, at 101 years old, is still driving his Mercedes. I told him that he should move to Florida. That's the norm down here. And then, sadly, the lower left picture on U-Boat 5, that was my best friend in Germany, Hess. He was the youngest combat commander who saw heavy combat. There were a couple of guys younger than him, but he saw heavy combat. I was over to visit him some years ago. He was 82 years old. He was in great shape. A couple months later, the main TV station over there and one of their researchers came out with a horribly defamatory so-called special about the nasty guys in the Wehrmacht. And my friend Hess was a doctor of law. He filed a pretty massive lawsuit against this researcher and the studio. And would you believe, within a week, he had a heart attack and died. Damn coincidence.
Oh, really? Well, those coincidences. Yeah. Never quit.
Hey, let me throw out a special offer to your listeners. I've never done this before. If any of your listeners order any of our books, they can call us. The phone number is on the website, sharkhunters.com, and say that they heard us on the Rents radio program. We'll give them a 6-month membership for free where they get the magazine.
Oh, what a deal. What a deal. The magazine is magnificent. This is, I don't know how you do it.
It comes electronically. You get it. You know what it's like.
Oh, yeah.
So for 6 months, they'll get the magazine. They'll get all the benefits of membership. The magazine comes electronically as you get it. If they mention they saw or heard us on the Rents radio program tonight and order any of these books, they get a free 6-month membership.
Well, again, they're a history, a living history, told by the people who lived it. And there's nothing like that. Nothing. Just extraordinary. The last cover we have on the page is David's most recent non-U-boat or Eagles cover. It's the Hitler and the Secret Alliance, which I again, think is a marvelous cover.
Especially, that's probably one of the best he's done. That's beautiful.
Well, the bottom, on the bottom of it, showing the swastika floating on the gorgeous lake. Just amazing.
There's a whole lot more story behind that than what even David knows. There's more than you know, and one of these days I'll tell you. But it just by sheer coincidence, that's what he did. But there's a hell of a story behind that image.
Wow. Which lake is that?
Yep. That's a lake down there.
Which lake is that?
I don't know which lake, David. What lake did you pick?
That would be the lake. Let's see. It's the town was Bariloche.
At Bariloche.
Yeah.
So that's the big lake.
Yeah, that's Lake Nahuelwapi.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, that's the lake up one finger of which had the residence built by the Mercedes family that Hitler and Eva lived in for 10 years.
That's right. Incidentally, we have a brand new website, so if they go to sharkhunters.com, they've got all sorts of options. We have a shopping cart on there, too. But unless they call us and tell us that they heard us on Rents Radio, we won't know to give them the free 6-month membership. So our phone number is on there. They can get anything they like. Our fine art prints that are hand signed by these great veterans, Americans, some Americans, mostly Germans.
Uh-huh.
Our DVDs, our CDs, also our books. They've got a shopping cart, and with PayPal, they can use any old form of payment, including wampum beads, I guess. But if they call us and order the books from us over the phone and say they heard us on Rents Radio tonight, they get a 6-month free membership, and they'll get the magazine electronically.
Very good. All right. David, anything you want to add in summation here? We got about three minutes left.
I'd like everybody to go buy these books. I think if you collected all of them, you would have a piece of history that very few people would ever be able to own. You could make a great library out of them.
Well, you can educate yourself literally about an epoch in our relatively current history that few understand, except for the propaganda crap that is forced down our throats from the time we begin government schools.
Triumph over evil, right? Yeah, that's what's on one of the TV channels now.
Is that it? Triumph over evil.
Yeah. Incidentally, there's another, I think you know, Jeff, the Hitler in Argentina book, we are offering that in hard copy, but it's not for sale. We'll give it to anybody free if they make a donation of $150 or more to our nonprofit corporation, Shark Hunters Institute. And that's funding my next expedition down there, as you know, to Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and Paraguay. And anybody who donates $150 or more gets a hard copy. There's only 200 made, period. They're numbered. They ain't going to be more than 200. They also get a copy of that DVD, 90-minute long DVD
which I have not seen yet, and in fact, I haven't gotten mine yet. Hopefully, you can find one. Tell Santa.
Hell, I'll send you one. I thought we had sent you a DVD already.
And the book, I'd love to get a copy of the book, too.
Okay, and then
my illustrated book, remember that?
David,
his own book, we want to mention. David Dees has his first edition out of covers that he's done for Rents.com, splash art covers.
Wow.
And you can get them. Tell them where to go, David, to get it.
It's my website. It's spelled DDEES.com. That's DDees.com.
That book go ahead.
And it's there's a button you can click. It says the book, and it's 114 full color pages, and it's
stunning
awesome.
Covers. David's splash art is again without any equal on the planet. I've seen a few people try and copy him, but no one can do it. There's some inspiration there that comes from somewhere that is just in a whole nother level. And it's always a thrill to see these things materialize and get worked out and to be able to post them. So go to ddees.com, DDEES.com, and get a copy of that book, another fabulous Christmas gift. That book you hand to anyone, and they open it up at any page, and it immediately provokes thought. You cannot look at it or any of those images and not start thinking about important issues. It's an incredible medium that he has pioneered and brought forward. It's just remarkable. So do that, hopefully. Thank you, David, for being here.
Thank you, and good night, Harry.
Good night, David.
Okay. All right, Mr. Cooper, I'm going to say good night to you. There's a story I ran today, last night late, about one of Hitler's watercolors going up for auction, expecting around $50,000, $60,000 for it. It's a very handsome painting done in 1915, and I wish I was in a position to bid on it. I'm still.
yeah, you and me both.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to visit a friend over there, Manfred Roeder, who was the most radical right winger according to the government there, and the room I had an original Hitler painting hanging in it.
Yeah, well,
guy was a pretty fair artist.
You know, he's a very good artist. You know my story about six I had and the small ones. And so anyway, look around the military show there. See what you see.
If I see your pictures, I'll holler.
Or if you see one for sale, buy it for me and I'll pay you back. All right.
Yeah. I got about $40 in my pocket right now.
All right. Have fun, Harry. Thanks. Been great.
All right. Sharkhunters.com. Thanks for having me on, Jeff. Good talking to you always.
Thank you. Get well. Alrighty.
Alrighty.
Okay. Harry Cooper. And that's hour number two. Be right back with hour three in just a few minutes.